unless the clean products become price competitive, it's very difficult to create markets in wind and solar. It took almost 4 decades for that to happen. We know that we don't have this time.
Welcome to Radio Davos, the podcast from the World Economic Forum that looks at the biggest challenges and how we might solve them. This week, energy. Many of the innovations we need to get us to net zero are out there. How can we get them scaled up fast enough?
There's a whole slew of promising clean technologies out there that we now need to de-risk and help stand up. Only a clean technology that is actually used can help us decarbonize.
We hear from members of the World Economic Forum's Advanced Energy Solutions community, which brings together innovators, investors, and regulators to try to chart a way forward all around the world.
If you ask the question, will India lead the energy transition momentum around the world? Yes, it will. But the solutions that we're going to develop would be more applicable for economies like India. We need to look at these global technologies, but bring them to the country in a manner that addresses the specific needs of the Indian society.
From a big producer of batteries in India to a Belgian startup putting solar panels on people's homes for free.
What we build is a virtual or decentralized or digital grid, so to speak, and we match production consumption.
Subscribe to Radio Davos wherever you get your podcasts, or visit wef.ch/podcasts, while you also find our sister program programs, Meet the Leader and Agenda Dialogues. I'm Robin Pomeroy at the World Economic Forum, and with a look at advanced energy solutions,
tangible actions that are today and tomorrow and next year. A lot to be done, but we need tangible action.
This is Radio Davos.
Welcome to Radio Davos, where this week we're talking about advanced energy solutions. And I'm joined in the studio by Jeremy Juergens, who's a managing director of the World Economic Forum. Jeremy, how are you?
Good. Great to be here with you today, Robin.
Lovely to speak to you, Jeremy. Now, energy and new technology are two very important areas for the World Economic Forum, and they come together in this thing called the Advanced Energy Solutions Community. Could you tell us what that is?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you step back, you can see that actually energy is underpowered industry since the second industrial revolution, if not earlier, and continues to be absolutely critical to every industry today. And now today we also have everything around AI and technology more broadly, which is also going to be central to every industry and every sector. The advanced energy community actually brings these two domains together and say, what are the new energy solutions that will actually help us drive a sustainable, affordable, and secure energy future?
And you bring this community together actually in person.
That's right.
Because I conducted 3 interviews, which we're going to hear in this episode. Very different. What's quite impressive about this group is it's every imaginable kind of angle on energy. I mean, could you give us some idea of the diversity of the people who would attend a meeting like that?
Yeah. So, you know, we have a range of individuals here because, you know, you may have startups that are, you know, driving new energy solutions in a specific domain. Could be in solar, in fusion, in connecting grids. Then you have policymakers who are actually important to actually understand how these new technologies are evolving, and what do we need to do to make sure that the regulatory environment adapts as well. You have financiers that are actually helping fund the rollout, where we're clearly underfunded where we are today, and we'll need to put in much, much more capital to help drive these solutions forward. Of course, there's the expertise and knowledge that comes from the large established energy companies. And then as well, you have a broad set of consumers that are actually using these energy and these new solutions, and they're really important to bring together the right demand signals. So we try to bring all of these groups together where they might not necessarily normally meet around this specific topic and actually understand how we can actually accelerate investment in advanced energy solutions.
We're going to hear a couple of interviews from people in one or two of those niches, but the first interview we're going to listen to is Anne Mettler of Breakthrough Energy. Could you tell me something about Anne Mettler?
Yeah, I mean, Anne's great. She's at Breakthrough Energy Ventures, where they're actually helping catalyze new technological solutions with capital and by looking at public-private partnerships there. And so a lot of the times we actually need to seed these new solutions, and they're looking at a broad-based sector of new technologies to help drive that.
Let's hear Anne Mettler.
Breakthrough Energy was founded in 2015 by Bill Gates in an effort to help stand up a new generation of clean technologies. And we're very much guided by science and innovation, and we work across the innovation cycle. So from discovery to development to deployment.
So you're going out looking for new innovations.
Absolutely. We believe that there's a current set of mature clean technologies, and we absolutely need these. But we also believe that we need new clean technologies that now need to be scaled, and we need to lower the cost. This is what Bill Gates likes to call the green premium.
What does he mean by the green premium?
The green premium is essentially the difference in price between a clean product and one that has to compete with a product that is probably cheaper because it is CO2 intensive, a polluting product. And we are working to bring down the cost differential because unless the clean products become competitive, price competitive, it's very difficult to create market. So if you look, for instance, in wind and solar, where we have, broadly speaking, reached price competitiveness, it took almost four decades for that to happen. We know that we don't have this time. So this is why this is so urgent, the reduction of the green premium.
And how do you achieve that? Is that a matter of scaling up? Because I think for wind and solar, people were surprised when what seemed like suddenly this was cheaper in many cases than kind of fossil fuel energy. What needs to happen to allow things to scale up and to become cheaper?
Completely. I mean, it's a process. It starts at the early stages with R&D, and then we essentially need to figure out how to quickly scale, as I said before, and bring down the cost. But it's a little bit a chicken and an egg problem because unless it scales, the cost doesn't come down. And so generating demand for a product that is not price competitive is challenging, but it can be done and it has been done. So if you look, for instance, in solar, in the early days of solar, Germany had a feed-in tariff, which guaranteed a certain price, and that actually helped stand up this technology. So this can be done across a whole slew of new clean technologies, and these are the kinds of models that need to be studied.
The German example that you give shows the importance, I suppose, of public sector and private sector. What was happening there was those government policies were encouraging private sector companies to produce solar energy and consumers to use solar energy. Where do you see that kind of public-private partnership when it comes to the kind of energy transition?
Well, it's critical because neither the public sector nor the private sector can achieve this on their own, right? So they need to work in tandem in a way that I think they haven't done today. So, and the onus is really very much on the public sector, if I can say so, because we work with the private sector and startups in particular. So we know that there's a whole slew of promising clean technologies out there that we now need to de-risk and help stand up. And what I can tell you is in energy, you don't move an inch without public policy. Everything is regulated. So the onus, as I said, is on the public sector to try to figure out how can we enable the private sector? How can we unleash these innovations and these technologies? And I know a lot of thinking is going on in that respect, and I welcome that. But I do urge a clear focus on speed. A lot of this takes too long, and really understanding that unless the technology scales, you're not going to bring down that cost. That means, you know, you're not going to achieve your goals because only a clean technology that is actually used can help us decarbonize.
So that's interesting what you're saying. You could have the best idea in the world. You could be an entrepreneur with a fantastic product, but no one's going to invest in that if the policy landscape isn't right for it.
Exactly. And this is the perennial chicken and egg problem, right? Because for the most part, our economy still operates sort of in a regulatory and policy environment that was built for the industrial age. But we're trying to have a new industrial revolution built on clean technologies. So a lot of changes need to be brought underway and very quickly.
You're Vice President Europe, correct, for Breakthrough Energy. So maybe you can talk to the policy situation here, because we've seen in America massive policy changes with the weirdly named Inflation Reduction Act, which is actually not about inflation, but seems to be all about the energy transition. How do you compare America to Europe? And do you think things need to go faster in Europe now?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, to say, I mean, the original leadership for climate came out of Europe, right? And also with the European Green Deal, we have a legally binding framework now that essentially is supposed to bring us to net zero. However, what I would say is, and this is becoming clear in the European context, we cannot regulate ourselves to net zero. And I think this is why the Inflation Reduction Act was actually a welcome wake-up call in Europe, because we understood that both mature and emerging clean technologies are at the heart of the energy transition. So in that sense, I actually believe that the Inflation Reduction Act is cleverly worded because, A, it drives public acceptance because no one wants inflation. But secondly, I would also argue it's correctly worded because if you look at the inflation that we suffered in 2022, a lot of that was driven by the high price of energy, fossil energy. And we need to be very clear that if we want to get a grip on this, yes, we need to invest now in these emerging clean technologies, but the payoff over time will be lower inflation because a lot of these technologies actually can help bring down the cost because for wind and solar, they, as I said, they are price competitive already.
Yeah, we saw that really in Europe, didn't we, with the invasion of Ukraine. Very much coincided. It wasn't the only reason for that massive jump in inflation, but it was a big one, wasn't it?
So. Huge. I mean, there was a study out this morning that says that in Germany, at least 50% of the inflation in 2022 was driven by the price of energy. And this poses a significant policy challenges because that means that central banks, which have a mandate to keep inflation low, have limited means because they're not in charge of the price of energy. So it really poses a conundrum that I think we haven't seen today.
So can you tell us anything about the trends that you're seeing or that we should be looking out for? Wind, solar energy, we've seen that come up over the past decades. Are there particular technologies or just trends in the energy transition that people should be looking at?
Of course. I mean, and in general, I would always encourage a portfolio approach. So there isn't one clean technology that is sort of the silver bullet. However, we know that, especially in Europe, since we're really doubling down on solar and wind, we will need that to go hand in hand with storage because wind and solar are intermittent energy sources. So what do we do if there's no sun and there's no wind? So by definition, we need long duration energy storage. So that would be one area that I would favor. Europe has also made a really big bet on hydrogen, in particular on green hydrogen. A lot of reputation, I would say, is at stake here for Europe to really show and demonstrate it can be the leader that it has said it wants to be. I think there's a huge scope also around sustainable fuels in aviation and shipping. We know we need new types of fuels. Also, a big one for Europe is how to decarbonize the industry sector, where we know it's particularly difficult. If you look at steel, you look at cement, you look at chemicals, those are sectors that are extremely difficult to decarbonize, but where, for instance, industrial heat, clean industrial heat, can be a real solution. So we really need to zero in on the technology solutions and then need to invest in these and help scale them. But it's absolutely doable. The technologies we need are out there. It's now really a matter of bringing about the catalytic systemic change that is needed.
I've just got back from an AI summit, a World Economic Forum event about artificial intelligence. And it really is obviously flavor of the month. It must be something obviously that Bill Gates is very interested in. But are you seeing that already in the energy sector? Because AI, the proponents of it say it could solve some of the big issues like climate change. It's not yet clear to me how it might do that. Is AI and that kind of technology?
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer in that there is a strong intersection between digital technologies and clean technologies. And I'll tell you why. If we're looking to reduce the carbon footprint, how do you do that unless you actually have metrics? So if we were to digitize the power grid, we would have much better metrics over when is power used, who is using it. And if everyone had access to this data, including at household level, and you could aggregate that data, right, in a big data pool, you could gain very important insights. So I absolutely see the application of AI in the fight against climate change. And I actually ought to think that we double down on this, because where does the intelligence, right, a artificial intelligence, where does the intelligence come from? It comes from data. Are we collecting that data? Are we synthesizing that data? Are we trying to understand that data? I would argue no. And what I can tell you, having worked in public policy for a long time, unless you can measure it, you can't manage it. So oftentimes we are actually operating in the dark. And here we really need to bring those two communities, the AI community and the clean tech community, much closer together.
You're here in the World Economic Forum in Geneva attending this Advanced Energy Solutions meeting, which is lots of companies who are innovating in energy. I mean, what's been your impression of the event?
Firstly, it's like a dream come true, because if you look at people who operate at the clean technology frontier, we don't always have a chance to meet one another, especially when it's across geographies, right? Because we had fabulous colleagues from India, from Saudi Arabia, from Turkey. So extremely interesting and very necessary, because these are the people that in many ways chart the future. And I think what we collectively learned is that even though we sort of have a broad understanding of these clean technologies, emerging clean technologies, it would be a fallacy to assume that everyone else does, and the policymaker in particular. One of the points I made based on my experience in public policy is, unless the policymaker knows where the technology frontier lies, he or she cannot regulate for the clean technology frontier or set the standards or invest in that, because they don't even know it exists. So there is a big onus on that group, I think, to almost have a pedagogical approach to what they're doing, because they're charting new ground. And it's really of critical importance that we bring others along. So I applaud the World Economic Forum for A, bringing us together, and B, a little bit of a challenge is for all of us, how do we mainstream that and really bring it into society where we can bring about the systemic change and the speed and the scale that we know is needed.
Anne Mettler of Breakthrough Energy. Jeremy, I think important to her is public-private partnerships, which is very much what the World Economic Forum is all about. How do you see that relationship between the private sector, the public sector, coming together on energy innovation?
Yeah, that's really critical that we bring these two sectors together. Neither party can do it on their own. The public sector doesn't have necessarily the expertise, the knowledge, the capabilities. And on the private sector side, they actually need clear signals and clear roadmap of where we're going in these domains.
Let's hear the second of our three interviews then. This is VK Samudrala of Amara Raja Energy Mobility. Tell me something about him.
Yeah, he's leading India's largest automotive battery and supporting capabilities company in India. And we've seen everywhere that electrification of the transportation sector will be critical in achieving both 2030 and 2050 or 2060 objectives around carbon neutrality.
Let's hear from VK Samudrala.
We are about 30 plus years company in India, and we started our business in India just about the time when economic liberalization happened in 1991. Our idea was to bring the latest battery technology to the Indian market and bridge the gap between what was available at that time in India versus what's the latest technology elsewhere in the world. The timing seemed to have been perfect, because the liberalization policies opened up the market. We could see the wireless telephony business growing up rapidly, and our battery product was a perfect fit for that, because the telecom towers needed a battery solution that doesn't need manual attendance and maintenance on a frequent basis. Over the last 35 years, we've actually grown our business in the battery area, offered a lot of solutions both for industrial customers as well as for automotive customers. Whatever we did was probably the first time in India in terms of offering the latest technology. But in the last 5 years, we have seen that there's a lot of competing advanced chemistries that are coming into the energy storage applications. So we said that let's diversify our product portfolio and also relook at our business models and relook at next 10 years in terms of not as a product company, but more as a solutions company. We are a listed company in the stock exchange in India, valued with about $1.3 billion on market cap, with more than $1 billion as a revenue. So we're the number two largest battery manufacturer in India at this stage.
Batteries seem to be an increasingly important part of people's lives. You mentioned mobile phones. People didn't have that a generation ago. Laptop computers, all these gadgets need power. And then also the industrial level, electrification is all part of the energy transition. What do you see as kind of the new products or the new uses for batteries? Or where do you think things are going in the next 3 to 5 years?
I would traditionally describe the battery applications on three fronts. One, like you said, you had mobile devices, if not mobile phone, that needed power. For example, power tools have been there. Garden equipment has been there. They needed batteries. You also needed batteries for DC power for certain communication-related equipment because that equipment works with the DC power, so batteries were required there. And then battery as an emergency power backup. These are the three classical applications that batteries have always been used. And lead-acid batteries, which is about 155-year-old technology, has been the backbone or the workhorse for this battery energy, you know, applications. But in the last 10 years, we have seen that there are strong new application segments that are evolving. Mobility, e-mobility has been one of it. And then the renewable energy space, where we are getting into clean energy generation. We needed batteries there to take care of intermittency of the power generation, either in solar or wind, or providing stability to the grid and providing peak load shaving applications. So these applications are significantly new, and the demand is significantly an order of magnitude higher in terms of capacity requirements. If I take an automotive vehicle, there's been a lead-acid battery sitting there providing the starting, lighting, and ignition services, but that's a smaller battery. Now you take an EV, you have a battery that's much bigger in size and almost 40 to 50% of value in terms of cost. So we are pretty excited, and it also required technologies on the battery area that are a lot more agile and flexible. I'll just give you three possible functional requirements that are very different from what batteries have been doing all along. You want batteries to be lightest, because on mobility application, you want the battery to be, you know, not weighing too much, but give you enough power. You'd like to see that if you put a battery on a vehicle, the battery has its life as long as the vehicle is existing. And you want the battery to be charged faster. So you want fast charging, long lasting, and the lightweight functionality, which lead acid cannot offer in a significant manner. So you see new chemistries coming up. Lithium family is one of the most popular right now, but I'm able to see that there are a lot more new technologies and chemistries that are evolving in the space.
You're based in India. How do you see kind of the wider the energy transition happening in India? Do you think India is well placed to be some kind of a leader in the energy transition?
The Indian society needs energy solutions which could be pretty unique. First, I would like to acknowledge that India has one grid for the whole country. So we have a unified grid that's delivering the electricity as a part of the energy needs. Largely, coal-fired thermal power plants are the ones that produce electricity requirements for the country. And we all have oil-based energy sources for mobility and industrial applications. Now, 10 years ago, the government had a clear vision to enhance the clean energy component in the overall energy basket. And if I look at the progress that we have made as a country, I think we have done pretty well for ourselves. Today, approximately 27% of generation capacity of electrical installations are based on either solar or hybrid. As we see, by 2030, there is a clear policy by the government to get to about 500 gigawatts of renewable energy. The energy capacity will grow to about 870 gigawatts. So you're having more than 55% of the overall energy basket from a generation capacity perspective coming from renewable sources. But we also know that renewable sources have intermittency, low PLF factor, the plant load factor. Thermal power plant probably has about 65%. So if you have 100 units generating capacity, it actually generates 65 units. But a similar 100 units generation capacity for solar can only generate about 20 units. So we need to increase the PLF factor for solar and wind. And we got to also look at how do we enhance the storage capacity because of intermittency. So if you ask the question that, you know, will India lead the energy transition momentum around the world? Yes, it will. But the solutions that we are going to develop would be more applicable for, you know, economies like India, where there are a lot of developmental needs. The economy is in a developmental mode, and then the scale is evolving in certain applications. So we need to look at these global technologies, but bring them to the country in a manner that addresses the specific needs of the Indian society. As an example, if you look at mobility as a challenge, India consumes a lot of oil for its transportation requirement, and we don't have enough oil resources, so we import a lot. So transitioning to electric mobility would solve some other problem by developing domestic capability in creating the electric vehicle component ecosystem. Now, what India needs is not, you know, a large, long-range mile vehicle, because Indian commute requirements are very different. So we see a big revolution happening in the light electric mobility solutions. The two-wheelers and three-wheelers provide for 70% of the mobility needs of the country. And when you have such kind of, you know, very different end-use application, it's important for us to develop solutions that are aimed and, you know, customized for those requirements. So as an industry participant, I see that the responsibility for, you know, companies like Kapan Raja is to innovate in that area, derive the strength of global technology development, but apply it to the Indian context by innovating on the solutions that you offer to the market.
You say it's a very different marketplace, but probably some of those innovations, two, three-wheel vehicles, there would be a market for those around the world as well. Do you see that?
Absolutely. I'm very clearly seeing a trend that with the electric powertrains, the local mobility requirements will be more and more met by the light electric vehicles like two-wheelers and three-wheelers, whether it is people or logistics needs. And except for the climatic challenge that we have, that these vehicles may not be very convenient to use around the year, but a majority part of the year, you can still use these electric platforms or for light electric mobility for local commute of, let's say, you know, 15, 20 mile range. That basically means that you don't need a big battery that you would need probably in a large, you know, passenger vehicle. And hence, you can actually put more electric vehicles on the road with smaller battery capacities. Because we know that there are supply chain challenges of being able to meet the battery demand. You know, one smart way of solving the problem is make smaller packs and then build more electric vehicles.
You're here at the Advanced Energy Solutions meeting at the World Economic Forum. What's been your impression of it? Lots of people from different parts of the world in different parts of the industry, or different industries even.
I think there are three things that came out very clearly. Energy transition is a must, it's not a choice. But are we able to navigate through this energy transition in a manner that we are making the future of energy more affordable and cost competitive? Is there a premium to be paid for this energy transition? And if there is a premium to be paid, who is going to pay the premium? If you expect the consumer to pay the premium, how are you going to motivate and educate the consumer that in the transition to clean mobility or clean energy, you got to pay more for it? At this point of time, it costs more. But the conversation then, you know, moved on to, can we innovate a lot more to ensure that the cost of clean energy is not burdensome on the society? Because if you need partnership with the consumers and their buying into this whole initiative, either from the government or from the industry, you have to make them understand that there is value for them.
VK Samudrala of Amara Raja Energy and Mobility. Let's go to our third and final interview from the Advanced Energy Solutions event. We're going now from India to Flanders, I believe. Martin Michielsens of Energy Vision. What do you know about Energy Vision?
Energy Vision is a solar panel manufacturer in Belgium, providing home-based solar solutions, an important element in the energy equation.
We're a Belgian company, also active in China and north of Morocco. And we want to include a maximum number of people, families, SMEs into the energy transition. So we install, for instance, solar panels for free and then sell the energy to them. So no need to invest for our customers.
Was this a demand you felt was out there, that people were hesitating about putting in solar panels?
When we started our company in 2014, you just had a few years of huge subsidies that then stopped, and all of a sudden the market collapsed, confidence was lost. And basically we said, well, the technology is mature, so we don't need the subsidies. But still, in order to get over these barriers, technical, financial barriers, let's give the advantage of the technology without the burden of the cost. And so you have the added value, but that comes with an added cost. So we want to get rid of the cost to give the value to the people.
So how would it work then if I'm living in a place where you run this service, let's say in Belgium, what would I do? What would you offer me?
If you would be a family or a household, we would, for instance, put solar panels on your roof. You wouldn't pay anything to us for the installation. We don't get paid by subsidies. At the end of the day, we get paid by the energy you consume. So we sell the energy at a much lower rate than the normal energy price, for 50 or 80% discount. But in general, you would only use 30 or 40% of the energy we produce. 60% goes into the grid and is lost. And that energy, we direct it towards our electric charges and then sell it for people that charge their car. And so we have local green, cheap energy for people who charge their car. And that's how we make our profit. So by the energy you consume and you pay to us, we recover our investment. The energy we sell to the car drivers, that's how we make profit, basically.
With electricity, I'm often confused because you have grids and people feed in and you're never quite sure where that electricity has been generated. So is yours, you say it's a local charging stations. Are you actually kind of wired up then to these houses, or is it actually you're putting it into a grid and pulling it back off the grid?
We use the grid. We use the grid indeed. So well, of course, if we sell energy to your house, we don't use the grid. It's local, but then everything else we inject into the grid and get it out and we match it. Because in general, I mean, electricity or energy sector, that's production and consumption, and both are two pillars, but both are misery, basically. And production, if we try to sell solar panels to you, you would go to a competitor, you would ask a lower price, you would negotiate with us to have a lower price, we would have to reduce our quality. So it's really misery. And at the end of the day, an installer builds and gets 3 or 4% profit and has 10 years of risks and liabilities. Misery. In consumption, it's something similar. If you're an electricity supplier, you would buy electricity from the market and sell it at a 2% margin to a customer, and then Russia enters Ukraine and prices triple. But even then, those energy suppliers don't make any profit. A lot of value gets lost in between this production and consumption. And that's what we try to match. So in production, we have a very simple model. You don't pay for solar panels, you pay for the electricity. In consumption, we direct the excess energy here towards our customers or our charges. And that allows us to have very predictable revenue streams. We know the investment costs of our installation. We know the output. We know the lifetime. So we know the cost of electricity, cheap. And we sell it here at fixed price as well. And the result is that those people, drivers or people who can't have solar panels on their roof, they have predictable energy costs. And even during the crisis, we did not increase our energy price. We kept it stable and we made a profit. And those energy suppliers that tripled their price, well, they still acted at a loss, basically. What we build is a virtual or decentralized or digital grid, so to speak, and we match production consumption while using the normal grid. That's basically what we do.
And this model, is it unique to you? Is it happening around the world?
I hope in 5 years from here, it happens everywhere. Today, it's quite unique, but it's really something. I mean, we ask companies to copy us. You know, we have a great business case in Flanders, in Belgium, with social houses. You know, typically social houses, so you have families who cannot afford a house, they get a house from government and they pay a lower price. Typically those people have subsidized energy bill as well. So they pay a social tariff, so to speak. So it costs enormously to government, because a social tariff means you have your energy price, social tariff versus the market price, the difference is paid by government. During the energy crisis, we're talking about billions of euros of subsidies. And those people cannot buy solar panels. First of all, very often they don't have the means, but certainly they don't own the house, so they cannot put solar panels on it. So then we step in. What we did is, it's a project called Aster. It's a very long name, but that's the abbreviation. Aster is basically saying, so we install solar panels on a social house. The family doesn't pay anything. For the energy you consume, we will charge you a price lower than the social tariff. So the family really has an incentive to use that energy because it's cheaper than the social tariff. There's zero subsidy. And at the end of the day, the government saves a lot because they don't have to intervene anymore on the social tariff. And we recover our investment. Aster recovers their investment. social families or social housing area is very happy because they pay lower prices, and government is happy because they don't have to pay the energy bill anymore. It's a model that really works. And we started it 12 months ago. Today, more than 8,000 families already joined. We have an agreement for 50,000 families. But I mean, if you can do 50,000, you can do 500,000 or 5 million. So please copy that model. It's very simple.
What's the big barrier that you've experienced to it? I imagine, and other discussions I've had here in this meeting, is getting the alignment with policymakers. The policy scenario has to be right. If you've got a great idea, which sounds like your idea sounds great to me, I'll have a free solar panel and cheap electricity. But if the regulatory regime isn't right, it won't work. Is that something you've struggled with? Or
definitely. In all senses, I mean, policy and innovation don't go quite well hand in glove, so to speak. For instance, we give free solar panels. Okay, but the government says either a family buys a solar installation and we get VAT, or they pay for their energy bill and we get VAT. If you give free solar panels and cheaper energy, we lose on VAT, so we have to charge you. So basically, we get charged on the free solar panels we provide. Then we have these smart meters, but they don't really read out. I mean, in Belgium, we have a huge rollout of digital smart energy meters, but in reality, it doesn't work that well. So we say, so we will sell the energy and everything else we will put towards the charges, but it's really a pain in the ass to make it work, let alone to replicate it. And for instance, in the Walloon region in Belgium, the regulation is simply not ready to implement. So we have thousands of families on our waiting list. We have to wait for a new government and new regulation. So that's definitely something troublesome.
Beyond Belgium, beyond Flanders then, you mentioned Morocco, and did you mention China? What are you doing in those places?
Oh, we are very active in both countries. In China, we basically sell Chinese solar panels to Chinese customers, and they buy from us because we finance them and we come with European interest rates. That's how we started. We started as a very small company, 4 people, 6,200 euro equity, and we had a financial model, but no money. So we developed a system where Chinese customers buy Chinese solar panels from us, but they are backed by Belgian funds and state guarantees and cheaper interest rates, and the profits we reinvested in Belgium in our home market. That's basically how we started. To put it simple, Chinese government said, you cannot exceed a certain number of kilowatt hours because of pollution. So you have to reduce your energy spending. Otherwise, we triple your energy price. And then Chinese companies just calculated and said, okay, even if you triple the energy price, we still make a profit. So we just continue. And then they said, second stage, they said, well, if you still pollute that much, you go to jail yourself. That was something different. So they had to find solutions. Very often they didn't have the funds or the resources. So then we came up with a model, and we said European interest rates, which makes it much cheaper than your local bank loans, which were at 12 or 13%, and we were at 1% or 2%. So this way, we did hundreds of megawatts in China and then reinvested the profits in our home country. Same for Morocco. Morocco has huge lands, has a king that really wants to go in one generation from energy import to energy export. They have sun, they have wind, they have everything. And it was a new market, basically. Today, we have tens of thousands of customers that work along that model in both countries, and in Morocco as well, really increasing a lot.
I imagine you say you're selling Chinese solar panels to Chinese consumers. I imagine you're selling Chinese solar panels to Belgian consumers as well. Do you see changes in kind of global trade and the supply chain? There's political reasons, maybe economic reasons, that things are changing. Where do you see things going in terms of the supply of that technology, the hardware?
Well, we have in our board of directors a former European Commissioner of Trade who imposed sanctions on Chinese solar panels. But the reality is that European solar panel manufacturers don't exist anymore. Most of the solar panels come from China, and we are very strict on our supplier selection, very strict. But the reality is it comes from China. And you know, you have the rubbish quality coming from China, but you also have the very best quality coming from China. So it's the reality of things. Yes, we are highly dependent on Chinese manufacturers. That's true. On the other hand, we are not a company that tries to sell installations and then have to find customers every year. I mean, we have recurrent income. So if there would be disruption in the supply chain, at least our income streams continue. We just wouldn't add new projects for a while. It's a risk we are very aware of. Until now, it's very fine for us. We have huge stockpiles everywhere. But yeah, the innovation comes from China. The risk is Chinese. But on the other hand, I mean, China showed us the way. Without China, solar would never have rolled out as it did. I mean, it went 10 times faster, 5 times cheaper. That's also China.
So we're at this meeting, as we're recording today, the Advanced Energy Solutions meeting here at the World Economic Forum in Geneva. What impression do you have of the meeting, of this meeting of people from different parts of the energy industry, different parts of the world coming together?
Everybody understands that the challenge is huge, that there's no way back, that the way forward is very, very, very challenging, that it doesn't help much when the interest rates are increasing that high, especially in renewable, because that's always about project financing. And so the interest rates went times four in the last 12 months. That has a real, it's not a deal breaker, but it's a real impact. Everybody understands. The banks were also present. Everybody understands. On the other hand, what we often lack is public acceptance, or at least to include people. I mean, to be frank, I mean, it doesn't make much sense to talk about goals in 2040 or 2050, or to discuss about disasters at the other end of the world when, for normal people, I mean, basically, they struggle to get to the end of the month, or they don't look beyond their street or beyond their neighborhood. I also mentioned it yesterday. We do, as an industry, a very good job at telling our story very badly. We talk about these goals 20 years from here. I mean, let us try to talk about specific, tangible actions that don't go beyond people's life here on Earth, basically. I mean, that are today and tomorrow and next year. A lot to be done, but we need tangible action.
Martin Michelsen's of Energy Vision. Now, he makes the point that the regulatory environment is very important. All of us would love to generate our own solar power. Sometimes cost is an issue, but very often the regulatory environment is an issue for individuals and for companies making investments. That must be very important to the kind of conversations you have when the World Economic Forum is dealing.
Yeah, that's right. We need to continuously adapt the regulatory solutions to the current environment. If you look, for example, at how quickly solar costs have fallen over just the last decade, it's a completely different environment. And it means that we can use solar and other energy solutions in different settings and different contexts where they haven't been previously used. And so we need to continuously update our understanding of what is possible and how to most effectively approach these issues for policymakers to help shape a healthy regulatory environment.
Is there anything in all the conversations you have with this diverse worldwide group of people, anything that really excites you about energy innovation? Is there one or two things where you see real breakthroughs happening that maybe most people weren't expecting? I'll also ask, and or AI, everyone's still talking about artificial intelligence. It's a huge challenge because of the energy required to deliver AI. But do you see that as one of these big breakthroughs as well?
Yeah, let's start with the first question. I'm extremely excited about electrification. You know, 5 years ago, people didn't think we'd be as far along as we are today. And as we scale up solutions, particularly in the solar domain, as well as in storage, we actually see new opportunities being unlocked. Right, so it's actually feasible today to have not only electric cars, but electrified heavy transport for shipping, mid-range and long-range trucking. And these costs can be anticipated to fall much more rapidly as we bring manufacturing solutions to batteries and storage that were reserved previously for making phones and digital products where those are well understood. Now, if I look at the area around AI, this is going to be one of the biggest drivers of both energy demand, but as well as energy solutions. You know, today's data centers to run the latest AI chips, they're only about 20% full because these new chips consume so much energy that they don't even fill out the entire data center. So you literally have 80% of the space being unused because the chips for the AI consume so much energy. And if we look at the, you know, kind of anticipated demand in this space, that'll continue to drive demand for energy. What'll be important here is we roll out these AI data centers, that we also bring online quickly additional power here, and that power is green and sustainable. We can anticipate that this is actually going to drive demand for resurgence in nuclear power. And we also see recent advancements and developments in fusion, which has always appeared to be, you know, decades away. But for once, you know, it may actually be much closer than that. But you'll have to come back and check with me in another decade and see how that pans out.
Jeremy Juergens, Managing Director of the World Economic Forum. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Davos.
Thank you, Robin.
After recording that, Jeremy was heading to the Forum's special meeting on global cooperation, growth and energy for development, held in Riyadh on the 28th and 29th of April 2024. Around 1,000 leaders from business, government and academia are attending to address the challenges posed by an increasingly fragmented geopolitical and economic environment. Find more information and follow it at wef.ch/specialmeeting24 and across social media using the hashtag specialmeeting24. Please subscribe to Radio Davos wherever you get your podcasts, and please, if you have a moment, leave us a rating or review and join the conversation about podcasts on the World Economic Forum Podcast Club on Facebook. This episode of Radio Davos was written and presented by me, Robin Pomeroy, with editing by Jerry Johansson and studio production by Taz Kelleher. We'll be back next week with a special episode for the special meeting on global cooperation, growth and energy for development. But for now, thanks to you for listening and goodbye.